Guardian Unlimited.
I'm down here at the Turner Prize exhibition at Tate Britain in London. Always a show that gets everyone talking each year, the biggest contemporary art prize of the year. And I'm here with Adrian Sole, our art critic, who's going to take us around the show and tell us a little bit about what he thinks about it. Adrian, what marks out this year's Turner show for you?
I think one of the problems with any prize show is that it really pitches people who are making very different things against one another, and that's not always reasonable and fair. And so, you know, a painter versus a filmmaker who isn't really a filmmaker because he's also doing things which are a kind of sociological comment. And you think, well, that's like a horse versus a snake versus Heather Mills. And when I was a judge of the Turner Prize, there was a slight sense, again, of what are you looking for? You're looking for the best artist, the most interesting artist, the hottest property. Every year there's a different judging panel, and every year a different bunch of artists. And I guess I feel always that the art has to come first in the end, and whatever we all say about it is secondary. So how do you judge one against the other? Well, somehow you have to work your way through the minefield, you know. Let's go there now.
We've come through into the first room, which is the room with Mark Titchener's installation in it. If you're actually stood here, as Adrian and I are, there is the most amazing, bewildering set of things around us. Adrian, could you describe roughly what we're seeing, what we're standing in front of and among?
Well, we're standing amongst two what look like trees, but instead of leaves, they have these op-art discs which are revolving clockwise and counterclockwise, and which seem to be both kind of sticking out in the space towards you and receding at the same time. They're like mad science fiction things. I'm becoming so mesmerized I can hardly say anything anymore. They have this hypnotic effect. Also on some tables, there are what look like car batteries, which have got chiseled on them slogans which I believe come from trade union banners. All these are connected up in series, and these lead then go to something which looks like a Victorian pulpit, but which has also got a kind of New Age elements with crystals on it. And that in turn is connected to another sort of tree with dangly, weird signs. It all looks like science fiction come Buddhist prayer wheel come New Age nonsense. Mark's kind of good and very inventive, but I'm never quite sure to what purpose. One thing leads to another by process of kind of night moves and of a kind of logic which is constantly betrayed from first step to the next. I find it all oddly compelling, which is a kind of code way of saying it's sort of fascinating, but I haven't a clue what it's about.
Yeah, when I was here yesterday looking around the show, there was a woman standing just the right of where we're standing now, next to whatever tree-like object it is, and she was reaching out and she was touching the things that were hanging down, a bit like a kind of Christmas tree decorations or something, and one of the assistants rushed towards her and kind of wrestled away and said, "You mustn't touch this. You absolutely mustn't touch the artwork." And she's saying, "Well, I just didn't know. I was just trying to make sense of it. I've no idea what any of it means, and I thought I was being encouraged to touch it."
Touching it very lightly. These, I'm afraid, whether they give you an electric shock.
I can see something with this exhibit here. There is one law of physics here, which is obviously action and reaction. That is how I see it.
Feels a bit like that, doesn't it? As if you've got to try and work it out for yourself.
A little bit, yes. It also reminds me of that dreadful TV sci-fi series Torchwood. It's got this sort of similarly sort of clunky BBC sort of special effects department kind of aura to it. I don't really get it myself. But I guess it's all about beliefs of one sort or another, and it's all hollow, because, like, none of it takes you to God or to Karl Marx or wherever it is. You know, beliefs, where are belief systems? Perhaps that's what he wants us to ask. It's all very well to sort of signal questions about faith and about values and about belief. But all he's doing is kind of positing, it's a kind of, what the hell is it, response. And for me, that doesn't take me very far.
Maybe that's quite a good point to move through to the next room. We can get the hell out of here right now.
Let's go.
Adrian, we're surrounded by sculptures. Obviously, they're sculptures. They're not sculptures as I guess many people would think of them. They look like sort of organic objects, things that are half cooked.
I think they're meant to look very traditional in lots of ways, and they do. And they're on plinths. So you know it's a sculpture, it's on a plinth. These are Rebecca Warren's sculptures. All the ones on plinths are based on the human figure or bits of the human figure. Breasts kind of poke out of them and the odd bum. And some of the sculptures are kind of more like big puddings with the odd orifice or an ear or other bits of the human form or kind of part of this kind of seething lump. All of which is very self-conscious, and you're meant to think of the small group of sculptures that Willem de Kooning made in the 1960s, and you're supposed to think of Robert Crumb's cartoons, of very sexist cartoons in lots of ways, and I suppose Lucio Fontana's ceramics. Some of these are ceramic, and others are turned into bronzes, and some are pure plaster. She's obviously playing a game with the genres of sculpture, because also on the walls are a number of vitrines, which make you think, obviously, of Joseph Beuys. I like the vitrines a lot, and I think they're a way to go for myself, because there's an element of pastiche about the figurative sculptures for me, which, for all their kind of wild replays of other artists, they're kind of tame. They're the sort of thing that any collector would like, because they're not going to get all scared by it being too postmodern. I mean, it's postmodern enough in terms of all the references, but it also looks like traditional sculpture in lots of ways. And, you know, even the bronze has kind of got a kind of gold vulgar patina on it with little bits of colour. The vitrines are really knocked together, and bits of scrap wood, actual twigs, bits of neon. There's an idea of a sort of narrative going on inside them, but that they've got this nice odd sense of theatre, and I enjoy that, and I think they would make fantastic stage sets. I just think it's got to be better. I just think there's another level you've got to go to as an artist to really be really good. And neither she nor Mark, for me, have actually reached that next level yet.
Well, let's go through to the next room and see what we can see on the gallery walls there. Adrian was saying earlier that you're comparing artists who are totally unlike. From those weird organic forms in the previous room, the sculptures, we're now looking at a very, very regular set of paintings, 11 of them, I think, there are around the walls. All equally spaced.
No, actually, they're not equally spaced. Sometimes the gaps between them are larger than others. And I actually spent some time in here the other week, and I was very aware of this. She's played a lot with the order. I've seen most of these paintings before in a show that was in a gallery in South London last year. Again, it was in the winter, and it was only shown in daylight. To watch the light changing within the paintings as the daylight went was fantastic. We've got this kind of dead gallery lighting in here now, which flattens them out. The thing about them is that they are very flat in lots of ways, flat colour. She paints them all flat on a desk, and I think there's something to do with the fact that she's looking down at them when she's painting them. And she's painting these very shallow relief spaces, these forms, as if they were seeing form through a kaleidoscope, and it keeps shifting, and the planes are shifting over and between one another, and are being shuffled or are being placed together in a way which they're not congruent. It's almost as if there's a dimension to these that the normal Euclidean space can't quite deal with. The way things are folded and the way things, shapes are folded, sometimes they're like a handkerchief or a sheet of paper that's been crumpled and then reopened, but all the shadows aren't actually going in the right direction. And everything has got this slightly, not faded colour, but sour colour.
I did actually come into this room and say, this looks like the foyer of an art college in the 1970s.
I actually was drawn to that one.
Why is that?
I think it's
coloured.
Well, it's nice colour. It seems to have a depth to it that the others don't have. It's almost like folded fabric, so I find it very pleasing to look at. I actually like that. But then I've just read what she said about her work, that she has no concept,
no concept, and it kind of just happens.
She never knows where the painting's going to end up. She starts off with a drawing on the canvas, always working on the same size canvas, works it, paints it, discovers an image, somehow disrupts the image in some way, and some other new form will come in until she's, I think, found a kind of psychological space, which is a kind of pictorial synesthesia. You know, this synesthesia where you can smell colour. Very interesting the way that the paintings are like all the same size, They all demand that you get up close to them and hold you there. They have kind of oddly hypnotic feel to them. And they're all very different. It's like you're putting your... Each time it's a very different experience, but it's almost a kind of phenomenological experience as much as a picture for me. And paintings, I think... She said something once when she was talking to Peter Doig in an interview about wanting to make paintings, wanting to imagine what the paintings of the future might look like. Oddly enough, they look like the past. I think I wrote that they look like some weird corner of modernist painting, you know, a bit like Polish Unitism or something that never really happened, but you were inventing it now as if you were faking part of modernism history. They get better for me. They get better and better, and... In a certain way, I kind of covet them, and wouldn't mind having one that I could hypnotize myself with. They have a very persistent logic, but it's not a logic. It's a logic that's taken a wrong turn somewhere. I think it's got this. They're very, very deceptive, very deceptive.
I think there's also what's amazing when you kind of get close to them as well. It's just the sheer sort of perfectionism of them. The detail is absolutely incredible. It almost looks. You know, from seeing from a distance, some of these look almost a bit untouched by human hand in a way. There's perfect. We're just looking in the distance towards one that's kind of a red squiggle on
a continuous squiggly line, hasn't it? That goes all the way over the canvas, kind of climbs all over it. That line.
And it does. And
you can't tell whether you're inside a shape or outside a shape.
And it looks amazing because it looks as if it's sort of just a projection of something that's happened. I can't almost imagine the precision of producing a line like that that looks both so organic and so made as well. It's incredible.
And the painting right next to it, to the right of it, which could be a bit of the Victorian metalwork or somewhere between Victoriana and Art Deco or something. And yet when you do get close, you see lots of imperfections. There is all the underpainting. You can see, as well as painted reliefs and painted ridges, there are actual bits where she's painted out something and left its trace behind, and yet they all those layers become part of the image somehow. It's quite incredible how much, yes, the details, but very much handmade.
Okay, well, from a room which is full of light to a room which is totally dark, and out the other side, well, we're going to talk about the final artist in the show.
Let's do it now.
Okay, we've come through this dark space. You've been able to hear in the background the sound of people speaking. There's a kind of dialogue, a weird video dialogue across the room, isn't there, Adrian?
Well, it's one of a number of series of interviews that Phil Collins had conducted with people who feel that their lives have been ruined by reality television, by their appearances on reality television. And there are hours and hours of these interviews. They're all taking place in Turkey. And he actually got a Turkish porn movie director to interview the subjects. Following these interviews, one comes out outside an office that Collins has constructed in the gallery, and it's called Shady Lane Productions, where people are in fact invited themselves. People visiting the Turner Prize can come and fess up. You know, most art that's kind of participatory is kind of ghastly and patronising and horrible in every way. You know, asking you to humiliate yourself or dress up in silly clothes or go down a slide. But he actually does provide an opportunity for the audience to kind of, to actually become part of the work. But you have to actually really make an effort, and you actually have to have a reason to do so.
It makes it quite interesting as well as a choice for the Turner Prize, which is, you know, the most media-saturated, obsessed-over prize in contemporary art in Britain.
Exactly.
To have an artist who's so interested in what the camera does to people and what media exposure does to people.
It is the case that artists who have participated in the Turner Prize have suffered quite badly sometimes. It's not just the work that comes under scrutiny, is it? The artists themselves come under immense public scrutiny. There's the good and bad side to the Turner Prize. The good side it being that, you know, you don't have to explain to every taxi driver what an installation is or why something's art or what it or isn't. It gets a lot of media attention. A lot of people come to it, except this afternoon, where the Tate Britain is rather quiet. And a lot of people talk about it. And winning the Turner Prize not winning it, does not make you a better or worse artist. There are good years and bad years. Sometimes you can be nominated before your time, or you don't have the right work ready.
And so who do you think Who would your money be on this year?
Money is one thing. I will imagine that there will be a bit of rancour in the jury room on Monday, the 4th of December. I always thought that the prize was going to be between Thomas Abbs and Phil Collins. My colleague on The Guardian, Jonathan Jones, wrote a few days after I expressed what I thought that he couldn't respect anyone who didn't think that Mark Titchener and Rebecca Warren would win. There is a split in the vote between Collins and Abbs, then the default winner is definitely going to be Rebecca Warren. I'm not a betting man, so...
We'll just have to wait and see. Adrian Zell, thank you very much for taking us round.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And if you want to come and see the show yourself, it's here at Tate Britain every day until January the 14th. And we'll be covering it on the website at guardian.co.uk/arts.
Guardian Unlimited.